Hey there, it's Joshua. Just a quick note before we start the show. A lot of news has broken today and is still breaking. The Friday News Roundup, of course, was recorded earlier, so we discussed a lot of what's been happening, but not everything. So to stay up to date on the very latest, you should keep an ear out on your NPR member station or go online to npr.org. Thanks. This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. George Herbert Walker Bush made quite an impression on the nation in his 4 years as president.
I think character matters a lot. I think you have to have a moral compass. Doesn't mean you have to have a pristine personal life. I never liked all these intrusions and stuff, but patriotic values, sense of service, those things mean something to me.
His legacy as a forward thinker on foreign policy and as a good friend and a family man were confirmed this week as America said goodbye to its 41st commander-in-chief. We will remember the first President Bush, President 41, along with the rest of the nation today. And we'll also talk about some of the big stories you may have missed this week and some stories that are breaking as we speak. Joining us in studio for the Friday News Roundup is Jessica Taylor, the lead digital political reporter at NPR. Jessica, welcome back to the Roundup.
Thank you.
Also back with us is Marketplace senior reporter Kimberly Adams. Kimberly, welcome.
Thanks, Joshua.
And at WFAE Public Radio in Charlotte is a previous guest of 1A, but new to the Roundup. David Preece is the chief operating officer of the Lawfare Institute, best known for the national security website lawfareblog.com. He's a former intelligence officer at the CIA, where he served as Robert Mueller's daily intelligence briefer for more than a year. His latest book is called How to Get Rid of a President, History's Guide to Removing Unpopular, Unable, or Unfit Chief Executives. David, welcome to the Roundup.
Hi, Joshua. Good to be with you.
George H.W. Bush is in his final resting place on the grounds of his presidential library at Texas A&M University. His burial yesterday culminated the first presidential state funeral in more than a decade, from Houston in a presidential plane to Washington, where he lay in state at the Capitol, to the Washington National Cathedral for an official funeral, back home to Texas for another memorial, and then a train trip to College Station, Texas. That's where the presidential library is. President George W. Bush eulogized his father at the National Cathedral.
Your decency, sincerity, and kind soul will stay with us forever. So through our tears, let us know the blessings of knowing and loving you, a great and noble man, the best father a son or daughter could have. And in our grief, let us smile knowing that Dad is hugging Robin and holding Mom's hand again.
President George W. Bush giving one of a number of beautiful eulogies at the service at Washington National Cathedral. Former First Lady Barbara Bush died months before the late President Bush. She's also buried at the library alongside Robin, their daughter, who died of leukemia at age 3. I'd love to get your thoughts here on the panel about the legacy of President Bush, starting, David Preece, with you, particularly your view as a political historian. I wonder what came to your mind first when we had learned that President Bush had passed away.
He represents so many things about the country that people think are representative of a bygone era, that this is something we're missing now and we won't get it back. What I found striking about the eulogies inside the National Cathedral and the commentary around it was something else, which was the reminder that he gives us about those values, that there's a void that we will fill, not that we will leave unfilled. That, in fact, his career of service, his dedication to country, his dedication to family should be an inspiration and not a lament of times past.
David, you served in the CIA under George W. Bush, the 43rd president, and you've written that, quote, the modern way the presidency interacts with the intelligence community began with the elder President Bush. What do you mean by that?
That's right. Before George H.W. Bush, no president had sat every single day while in Washington for the entirety of his presidential term with a working level officer of the CIA to talk through the contents of the president's daily brief, the highest level intelligence publication there is. Some presidents before him had done it occasionally. Gerald Ford had done it for the first year he was president, but nobody did it for an entire 4-year term until George Bush. He also instituted a practice, knowing, as a former director of Central Intelligence, as he was, knowing the sensitivity of the information that goes into this very exclusive document, he instituted a practice whereby he and the other recipients of the president's daily brief around town, such as the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense, they would receive a briefer who would deliver this daily document, and they didn't have to have the briefer talk to them. They could simply read it and have the briefer sit in the corner of the room quietly. But the briefer would be there while the senior person in the government was reading this document or getting briefed on it, and then would take the daily brief back to CIA headquarters to keep it absolutely secure. In the Reagan administration, the vice president, George Bush, had seen copies of the president's daily brief floating around. People were making photocopies of it. As a former director of Central Intelligence, he told me that he was very upset by this. So it's no surprise to me that when he was president, he put in a new institution which really solidified that briefing relationship of having a working level intelligence officer in the room. And that has continued to a large measure ever since.
Kimberly Adams, let's talk about the president's economic legacy. It's one of the things he's perhaps better known for, not only the relationships he built with other nations, there was also NAFTA. And then there's that famous campaign line of read my lips, no new taxes. Yeah.
Well, and to the points we just heard, it's sort of a relic of a bygone era that one of the reasons he lost his next election was because he did raise taxes as part of a compromise with Democrats to address budget deficits. And that's something that I think we really struggle to see nowadays when it comes to these really severe economic issues like budget deficits, like funding for different federal programs, the ability to reach a compromise when it comes to competing economic interests. And, you know, it's a little bit ironic that, you know, we're remembering the person who signed NAFTA, even though it was ratified under Bill Clinton, as we are waiting for Congress to see what they're going to do on the renegotiated NAFTA agreement.
Yeah, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, which has been signed by the heads of state. It still has to go through Mexico's National Assembly, Canada's Parliament, and Congress.
Doesn't roll off the tongue the same way.
It really doesn't quite. NAFTA as opposed to the USMCA. Yeah, it takes a little bit more explaining. Jessica Taylor, what stood out to you among the memorials on a political level? At least for me, it was interesting to see the way that the services took place, particularly the presence of President and Mrs. Trump. The late President Bush made no secret of his disdain for Donald Trump. And then just the tone of the ceremony, which was kind of amazing. You don't get to see that often.
Yeah, I mean, President Bush, before he passed away, he said that he had voted for Hillary Clinton, and his son, George W. Bush, has said that he voted for someone else. I mean, this is the Bush family made no secret that they were no fans of Trump, and it's not hard to see why, given just this President Trump has had a disdain for the Bush family and the way that he attacked Jeb during the primaries as well. But, you know, what stood out to me was, yes, I mean, Trump, you could see him sitting there on that row of all the former presidents, and he just looked uncomfortable. And it was sort of striking to see him sitting there, and he just looked just very sort of like he felt out of place. But, you know, the tone contrast that it was easy for me, I think, to draw parallels to when John McCain passed away a few months ago. That service, which President Trump was not invited to, had a very clear rebuke to the Trump agenda. This one, it was sort of more implicit. There was nothing, you know, saying, you know, America is already great or things like that too. But you know, as David said, you know, it's that sort of bygone era, and just the things that George H.W. Bush stood for, his military service, for instance, you know, just he's the last president that we had that served in combat. And, you know, we've completely bypassed a generation of Vietnam veterans that probably are never going to serve in the White House. And so it was that, I think, that, and just this, you know, married to the same woman for 70 plus years.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, that whole family standing there. And it just was very striking. And, you know, I think it was very moving for a lot of people, you know, like you said, just sort of that where, you know, he talked about honor and civility and just character in a way that matters.
There was also
Note, which is a lot of the takes after hearing those eulogies were, what a dig at President Trump, and how clearly these were references to the man sitting in the front pew. And I take exception to that, because every single word spoken about George Herbert Walker Bush in the cathedral would have been said about him regardless of who was president. These were statements of remembrance about a man who had a life well lived and lived a life in public service. These were not attempts to subtly punch back at Donald Trump. These were ways to honor a great man.
There was also a kind of an augustness to the whole set of ceremonies just from the trip to Houston, mm-hmm. the lying in state at the Rotunda, you know, that shot of Bob Dole being helped up from his wheelchair to salute George W. Bush. Sully, the service dog,
sitting by the dog.
Oh, man, my mother texted me. She's like, why do I cry every time I see Sully on television? There was just kind of there was a sweetness to it. There was an augustness to it.
Yeah.
The full military honors. Like, we don't see that often, but that's kind of part and parcel of the country.
And, I mean, funerals are a way for people to grieve and for, I think, as a country for us to grieve and to move on. You know, I grew up in the funeral business, in fact. So, I mean, you know, this is an important time for people to come together and to do this, you know, but, you know, there could be there's always sort of some awkward moments at funerals too. And I think President Trump's presence had that effect, but largely, you know, there were so many other ways that people were honoring him, from people standing in line hours at the Capitol to pay their respects.
There's also been this thread, Kimberly, in terms of the way we remember presidents in total. Farm Country tweeted, let's not forget the extremely racist, unfair Willie Horton ad when we remember George H.W. Bush. That was a new low in politics that rivaled Nixon. There seems to be this kind of a thread about the value of a eulogy versus the value of an obituary.
And you can say a similar thing about his economic policy. You know, we were just talking about NAFTA. NAFTA is something that a lot of people all over this country really feel strongly harmed manufacturing workers, harmed factory workers all over America, and really ushered in this idea that maybe free trade wasn't so great for everyone in America.
David, I wonder what your thoughts are in terms of the way we remember the totality of a president like George H.W. Bush. I have to say, I feel like one of the things that I was surprised was not brought up more was Dana Carvey and his impersonation of the president on Saturday Night Live, not only because it resonated at the time, but because the president proved he could take a joke. Like, this legacy has got a lot of facets to it.
Right. Not just that he could take a joke, but he ended up becoming friends with Dana Carvey.
Yeah.
Ended up inviting him, in a sense, into the family, joking about it, enjoying it. And it did create a stark parallel in some people's mind for, could you imagine Donald Trump inviting Alec Baldwin, who impersonates him on Saturday Night Live, and bringing him into the family and laughing with him and listening to music? It buggers the imagination that this could happen. On the issue of legacy, it is a complicated one. All of the things that have been said are true. Yes, he ran a horribly racist ad during a campaign. Yes, some of his policies don't look as good in retrospect as perhaps they did to some at the time. But that is the nature of a presidency. We don't have angels running for president. We have human beings. And every single one of them, even some of our icons in history, Abraham Lincoln, the more I learn about him, the more I realize what a flawed human being he was and how he rose above those challenges to overall have a great legacy. And that's really the overall picture. And during a funeral service is probably not the time when you're highlighting the worst decisions that someone has made in a decades-long public career. It's a time when you're talking about the values underlying that public career. But there's certainly a time in the obituaries and in the analysis to say, what could he have done better? What should he have done better? And what can we do better reflecting on that history?
All right, let's move on and talk about some big news from the White House. The president has announced that he will nominate William Barr to be the next attorney general, succeeding Jeff Sessions. He also announced that Heather Nauert will be the next U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. That'll be his nominee. Heather Nauert is now a spokesperson in the federal government, and then before that was a host on Fox and Friends. Let's learn a little bit more about these two, Jessica. Can you tell us a bit about William Barr? He actually has a connection to the late President Bush.
Yeah, he served as his attorney general, first as the deputy attorney general in the first Bush administration, and then as the attorney general in 91 to 93. And so he has experience running this, clearly. You know, it's been two decades since then. And his daughter, in fact, actually works at the DOJ already, working on opioid cases. You know, it's interesting because this isn't someone that's sort of, you know, within the Trump family or has been a big Trump supporter. So I think Trump is probably looking at this saying, here's someone who has been attorney general that gives him some credibility and possibly an easier confirmation battle. you know, of course, Republicans have gained seats in the Senate, so that makes it a little bit easier going in, but maybe dispel with some of the questions regarding that. And of course, the big question is how will he deal with the Mueller investigation? And one thing that he has said, he has expressed concerns over political donations by Mueller's team, saying that, you know, he wishes that they'd maybe remained a little bit more neutral in that regard. And this, of course, is something that Trump has repeatedly tweeted about as well. So that's something that could certainly come up.
David Priest, how would you kind of handicap the relationship between President Trump and William Barr potentially compared to the, to put it mildly, contentious relationship that he had with Jeff Sessions?
It's hard to say because it's not as if they have a close personal relationship or have any history professionally of working together. And what we have seen repeatedly with the president is that when he has advisors, cabinet officials who are doing their jobs and tell him news he doesn't want to hear, he lashes out. He punches back, as he says. He's a fighter. Well, sometimes they're just presenting to him what the law is, or in some cases, if it's policy advice, what they think would be best. So we don't know how that's going to work out. One of the interesting links with Bill Barr is that back when he was attorney general, and by the way, one of the youngest attorneys general in United States history, I believe he was 41 or so when he was made attorney general back in the Bush administration. But when he was attorney general, his assistant attorney general in charge of the criminal division was a man named Bob Mueller.
Let's talk about Heather Nauert now. Kimberly Adams, people have been kind of critical of her resume throughout, much more journalism and communications than politics or diplomacy. Not that
there's
I have anything
wrong with that.
Not that there's anything wrong with being a journalist, but there's that question of whether or not she has just the experience to be the chief ambassador of the United States. What's the read right now on Heather Nauert?
Well, I mean, I think we should step back and recognize that throughout his administration, President Trump has made it very clear that it's not necessarily someone's resume that matters the most to him when he's making these decisions. He cares a lot about personal relationships. He cares a lot about loyalty. He cares a lot about how individuals present in a role or play the part. And so, you know, regardless of, you know, her diplomatic credentials, President Trump has obviously made the decision that he feels that she can do this job because of who she is and how she communicates and how she interacts with him. Within the diplomatic press corps, you've obviously had some criticism of her for some gaffes that she has made in terms of, I think she made a flawed reference to D-Day as being a part of our good relationship with Germany. But for the most part, I mean, I think if you put somebody from a journalism background in that position, you're obviously going to get some of those gaffes. We'll see if it passes the muster of the Senate.
Let's talk about the Russia investigation. Today's a big day for Special Counsel Mueller's investigation into the Trump campaign. Soon we'll learn more about what exactly former advisor Paul Manafort is accused of lying about. Also, sentencing recommendations for former Trump lawyer Michael Cohen are likely to come down. And James Comey, the former director of the FBI, is back on Capitol Hill today. He will answer questions from the House Judiciary Committee and the House Oversight Committee behind closed doors. All of this comes amid the release of a heavily blacked out memo, a heavily redacted document regarding former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn and the information he provided to Robert Mueller's investigators. Let's pull this apart piece by piece, Jessica, starting with Michael Flynn. We've gotten a few comments regarding Mr. Flynn. Cosmic Miami tweeted, "By many accounts, Flynn had a distinguished military career. Why he pimped himself out is unknown, or maybe it is and will be known soon." Is that kind of the crux of what we're waiting to learn about Michael Flynn as to why he decided to do what he was accused of having done?
Yeah, I mean, there were so many redactions in that it's hard to draw too much from it. But I think the big thing that you could see is that he met with investigators 19 times. It's clear that Mueller believes that Flynn gave him substantial firsthand information that is credible, which stands in contrast sort of with what Manafort was seemed to have cooperated with him, that they believe that he reneged on that a little bit and stuff too. So they believe that Flynn has provided assistance. You know, what it could be, it could be something with Turkey, which he had a lot of dealings with. It could be with money that was tied to the Trump inaugural fund and different things too. So it's sort of a little bit unclear as of yet what sort of information he provided. But you're right. I mean, he is someone who had a military background, but then he sort of came into Trump's orbit, sort of bought into that. And to that, you know, he was chanting "lock her up" at the RNC convention and things like that too. So it's a little bit unclear sort of yet.
We should also be clear, Jessica, some of these documents as they've been provided are so heavily redacted. It's almost impossible to make heads or tails of them except that they exist, and they kind of, it's almost as if the document had been like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, it would have been Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer had a very shiny redacted.
It's
Mad Libs. Then Santa came to say redacted.
There could be anything.
Down in history,
right,
the end. Like,
right.
Right. It could be anything in between these.
Yeah. But I think, again, what is clear is that he has been helpful to the Mueller investigation. And that is a, you know, that is someone from Trump's orbit that seems to have flipped and to have provided some sort of information enough that was valuable to them that he's not recommending any jail time.
I am challenging one of our listeners to come up with a song called Rudolph the Redacted Reindeer. I want that song by Christmas Day. Give us a sense of what James Comey, David Priest, is being called to testify about. The fact that he is testifying is part of the story, but also the way that he is testifying has been a big part of the story too.
Yes, he fought the request that he testify behind closed doors. He says he wants to be an open book. He wants everybody to understand everything that's being asked and everything that's being answered, and is a little bit nervous about what's going to happen behind closed doors and then be misrepresented afterwards. So he fought, I believe, going to court even to try to find a way to get out of this impasse. And essentially they settled on the fact that, yes, he would testify behind closed doors, but a transcript would be made available so people would know what was said. There's also very little holding him back from coming out of the hearing and describing what was asked and what he said. But the focus is not going to be on his firing by the president. The focus is going to be on what were his decisions in 2016, why was he making them, particularly related to Hillary Clinton, revisiting that again. I think there will be more heat than light from this. I'm not sure we'll learn too much from this, as opposed to some of the sentencing memos for Cohen and the details of Manafort's cooperation or lack thereof. I think that will be more enlightening than the Comey hearings. But let's be honest, this is a gift to the president in that when there's a bunch of other news coming out that is likely to be less than encouraging to the president, you can just bring up Comey again and he can keep talking about that and trying to distract some attention away from the other bad news coming.
Of course, this is Republican sort of last gasp, but
trying
to get this out too, because Democrats have taken control of Congress. They now have the oversight oversight role. They can subpoena and things too. So, you know, you have the outgoing Judiciary Committee, Bob Goodlatte, who is doing this. He's retiring. So it's sort of their last way to sort of bring him in, as David said, sort of shift headlines and things to a focus on what happened in 2016. Which has largely sort of been litigated to an extent. And you know, I don't think we're going to see Democrats focusing on that much.
Also today, the president tweeted, "We will be doing a major counter report to the Mueller report. This should never again be allowed to happen to a future president of the United States." Kimberly Adams, I think the character in this I'm the most fascinated by is Michael Cohen. His role in this just keeps on evolving, and it's the fact that he provided information in exchange for a plea deal, he's become this kind of this new character in the drama that Donald Trump has pointed to as kind of the illegitimacy of this whole Mueller probe. Like, I feel like the Michael Cohen part of this, at least for me, is the most fascinating.
The made-for-TV movie?
Totally. Yeah.
Well, and what's interesting about those heavily redacted Flynn documents is almost the signal that they send to other people in this investigation or getting caught up in this of, you know, play along and here's what you might be able to get. In the same way that President Trump, according to many people who are looking at his tweets, is trying to signal to people using the example of Manafort that, you know, don't play along, or Roger Stone or someone like that. Don't play along and, you know, you will still stay in my good graces. Now, you know, Michael Cohen's story is very interesting. At one point, he said he'd take a bullet for the president. And now his lawyers are out there saying, you know, he wants to completely follow the law and he's turned a new leaf. And there was a compass metaphor in there somewhere as well. There's a wide orbit of people getting caught up in this who are having to make real decisions based on real legal fees and real consequences for both themselves and their families about how they're going to deal with this. There was a tweet this morning who I wish I could attribute it to the right person, who was saying, you know, if you were Trump's dog, you'd probably want a lawyer at this point.
One more thing, David, of someone who definitely has needed a lawyer for some time is Paul Manafort. I wonder, before we keep moving, what you think in terms of how his situation will shake out. Investigators say he lied to the FBI. Manafort's lawyers say their client believed he was being truthful. What do we think happens to Paul Manafort going forward?
The details here will matter greatly. There's no way in which this document will come out, unless a lot of it's redacted again, in which case we're in the same place we were with Michael Flynn. But the details should show exactly what he was untruthful about and exactly how they know. That is, what documents do they have or other testimony that is credible, which shows what he was saying that was deceiving investigators. You put it all together, too, and you get a really interesting game going on here, if you will, which is Michael Flynn, in perhaps the most serious position in the U.S. government pertaining to national security, with access to every bit of information that the intelligence community produces, was committing crimes at the time. But Mueller decided that he actually provided enough cooperation that he would recommend no prison sentence. If we see a similar thing with Michael Cohen, which is a dramatic decrease in the recommended sentence, mm-hmm. That's a real signal to other witnesses, especially paired off with the Manafort issue, that you cooperate and we will look out for you. You don't cooperate and we are going to hold you to the details that we have in other testimony.
Speaking of prison time, it's worth noting that former Trump foreign policy advisor George Papadopoulos wrapped up his 2-week prison sentence today. He was released from custody in Wisconsin. I want to start our conversation about this Senate hearing, the briefing from CIA head Gina Haspel. A bipartisan group of senators agreed that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman was responsible for the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. That includes Republican Senators Richard Shelby and Lindsey Graham. Senator Graham spoke to Martha McCallum Wednesday on Fox News.
I've gone from being this guy's biggest champion to being his biggest nightmare. And I would advise the president that people are sizing you up. The Iranians are looking at you. The Russians are looking at you. And this guy has basically disrespected us, you, and the nation, and all of our values.
But you don't
if you
think
let him get away with
through.
It, you're, if you let him get away with this, Mr. President, then you're sending a signal that you're just about transactions. You're not somebody special. And the President of the United States needs to be somebody special.
That was Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina speaking to Fox News. Jessica, we played that clip from Senator Lindsey Graham, and we've been talking about how senators have increasingly coalesced around the belief, the very solid belief at this point, that there's no way that Jamal Khashoggi could have been killed without the Crown Prince knowing about it, directing it, masterminding it, etc. I wonder what your sense is of this moment. This briefing seems to have been a turning point for some reason, but even if it is, it remains to be seen kind of what Congress is going to do about it.
Yeah, I mean, and Graham, I think, is the central figure in all of this, because as he even said, I mean, Graham is someone who despised Trump during the primaries, really berated him, and then has interestingly become one of his closest friends.
Right.
And on this, he is clearly breaking with him. You know, he said there's not a smoking gun, there's a smoking saw. And, you know, Bob Corker, the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, who's leaving, he said, you know, if you had seen this information, you would have convicted them within 30 minutes, or, you know, I think he said even 20 minutes later on. And, you know, just how they can draw such a succinct conclusion when Trump supposedly got the same information and has wavered just is such a it's just striking. And you're right. You know, what they can do, resolutions are different things, too. But I mean, Trump is still at the head of this. And it really, I think, sends a signal to the rest of the questions. What kind of a signal it sends to the rest of the world when you have the Senate saying one thing and then Trump still very much wavering. And then, you know, there's reports this week that the Saudis spent so much money at one of his hotels and different things, too. So it's a complicated web in there, too. And what it says about us as Americans and being able to tolerate, you know, this, too.
David Priest, I'd love to get your insights on this as someone with experience in the CIA, what it means for the director of the CIA, Gina Haspel, to brief a bipartisan group of senators, what the import of that was.
It's a stark example of something I've seen many times, which is you have some very good intelligence, sometimes exquisite intelligence, that the analysts put together along with what is unknown and their confidence levels, and it presents a very strong picture, something that you can say with high confidence is happening. But it is something short of direct evidence. That is, we don't have an actual transcript of person A saying something to person B. Well, what's always interesting is to see the reaction to that, is some people will say, this is as tight a case as we'll ever get. Let's go forward. Some people will say, but we don't have the smoking gun. You haven't proven it. And I think we're seeing that played out in a very stark way here. The president and some others are saying, well, we don't know exactly what happened. Well, that may be true, and it can also be true that the preponderance of evidence that we do have points to something happening. The CIA director's job is to go to the Hill and give briefings when requested to inform the relevant committees about what they know. That is part of the oversight role. And let's not forget, Congress has some real tools here. Yes, the president is commander in chief. Yes, he controls foreign policy. But the Senate can block arms sales. They can defund programs related to Saudi Arabia. They can hold public hearings and keep a spotlight on this as long as they want to. They can make this a center point of the confirmation hearings for the UN ambassador if they want to. There are many tools that Congress has to make sure that the spotlight does not go away.
Let's shift gears to congressional politics and politics across the country. Democrats are on the way into Wisconsin state legislature, but the Republicans, who are currently in charge, dealt them a blow on the way out. Republicans in Wisconsin approved a sweeping set of bills on Wednesday to limit the power of the newly elected Democrats. Those rules include a new limit on early voting and ceding control of a major economic board to the lawmakers instead of to the incoming governor. We did a longer discussion on that this week, which you can find online at the1a.org, but Kimberly Adams, part of the discussion that we had, basically had to do with whether or not this is just politics as usual in 2018, whether this is the way that it's going to go. It's kind of like, you know, selling somebody your house, and then when they arrive, they find that you left the lawnmower running in the living room and said, enjoy your new home. Or whether this is actually unlawful, immoral. This is not the kind of thing that should be tolerated. I feel like that's kind of where the debate sits right now.
I think, well, this isn't the first time this has happened.
No, we've
seen this elsewhere in previous elections, but this is a bit more visible, perhaps, in light of some of the other things that have been going on and these real questions about what it means and what should happen when control of it, whether it be a state house or Congress, changes from one party to the other. And so immoral or illegal, that's going to be probably hashed out in the courts, because as I understand it, they're going to be fighting some of these decisions. But elections have consequences, and we say this all the time, but previous elections have consequences for the current ones. Your previous elections in, you know, Alabama or Georgia have, you know, have an impact on how an election goes, you know, in terms of voter access. The previous election here, in this case that we're talking about, has an impact on what happens for the next incoming governor. And so we saw record jumps in voter turnout in the midterm election, especially among young voters. But this is one of these things that really indicates the importance of voting over time in terms of how transitions happen, as well as who actually comes into power.
And of course, early voting is one of the things that's affected by these rules. Thanks also to those of you in Michigan and Wisconsin and North Carolina and Ohio and states that have been affected by this. Matt in Wisconsin writes, this power grab in Wisconsin is a violation of the spoken voice of the people. By the way, lest we think the midterm elections are over, don't be silly, they're not quite over, including not in North Carolina's 9th congressional district. Multiple investigations are currently underway into whether a Republican campaign worker used absentee ballots to alter the vote in Bladen County. The head of the North Carolina Republican Party says if the fraud allegations are true, they plan to call for a new election. At the moment, at last check, the Republican candidate, Mark Harris, leads his Democratic rival by about 900 votes. One more thing, Jessica Taylor, before we move on from politics, the eternal betting match in terms of like who might run for 2020, former vice president, which is my least favorite parlor game in Washington. Like, if you're going to run, say you're running so we can talk to you about running. But former Vice President Joe Biden says he is, in his words, the most qualified person to run for president in 2020, added that whether he runs will depend on whether or not his family is ready. Should we even be, like, what should we be paying attention to at this point?
Well, I mean, I think that there's a list of like 40 people at this point that can run for, you know, vice president. During 2016, we had the sort of like varsity debate and the junior varsity debate. We may have like a third varsity debate or something.
Like a Pop Warner debate or something.
Yeah, for the Democrats. Who knows who's going to run? I mean, Biden is someone who I think clearly had his son Beau not passed away right before he was having to make that decision. I think he would have run in 2016. And who knows how history would have been changed by that. He is someone who I think has always sort of coveted this, truly does believe he is qualified. You have a lot of people that are urging him. He's also someone that has shown that he can sort of speak to this blue-collar Democrat in a way, the populist Democrat that President Trump was able to appeal to. So I think he's someone that's going to be in the conversation. We did have two people say this week that they were not going to run. Former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick has said he will not run. So cross that one off the list. And I think to the relief of many in the Democratic Party, lawyer Michael Avenatti has now said he is not going to run. So hopefully we can move on past that.
Although David, it's interesting, you know, when he said that he's the most qualified, my first thought was, okay, well, what does that actually mean you're going to be president? I mean, it takes more than qualification to lead. Abraham Lincoln once said, with public sentiment, all things are possible. Without it, nothing is possible. And I just wonder if the question in 2020 comes down to whether the Democrats need someone qualified, like Joe Biden, or one might argue Hillary Clinton, or whether they need someone moving, like Beto O'Rourke, let's say, like what the Democrats actually need to upset a president who won by being influential.
And there are parallels for each one. You can find people with great resumes like a George H.W. Bush who became president. But you can also find a person who ran for a Senate seat and lost and then was president a couple of years later. And that's Abraham Lincoln. Now, that is the last case when that has happened. But Beto O'Rourke actually could look back to that as a model for seizing the opportunity as it arises. Because, look, who has the experience? Maybe it's Joe Biden. There is some excitement for him, but not overwhelming. Elizabeth Warren seems to be prepping for a run, certainly at the National Cathedral when all of the senators and representatives were there after the service mingling. It looked like she was holding court. She had people coming up to her, talking to her. She was definitely in that campaignish moment. But the excitement around one candidate just isn't happening. And maybe it is a moment for somebody who has the charisma, who has the ideas, and can say that I've had enough experience that I can pull off a Barack Obama, where pulling on that limited experience, but being able to govern with the right support around me.
Let's shift gears now away from politics and talk about USA Gymnastics. The organization is still flailing in the aftermath of the disgraced former team doctor Larry Nassar and his conviction on hundreds of sexual assault charges. This week, USA Gymnastics filed for bankruptcy. According to the Wall Street Journal, the filing would, in its words, put an automatic stop to depositions and discovery related to USA Gymnastics lawsuits that were filed by Mr. Nassar's victims. Kimberly Adams, I get that this going bankrupt kind of changes the way that legal filings happen, but it kind of makes me wonder about the future of USA Gymnastics as an organization. I mean, the U.S. Olympic Committee was taking steps to revoke its status as the governing body of the sport here in the U.S., so it feels like the future of gymnastics in the whole country at an Olympic level is very much up in the air.
Right, and I think my guess is where we're going to see this going is going to rely very much on the gymnasts themselves, as opposed to the people in these organizations, as opposed to the leaders in these training facilities all over the country and all of these various disgraced individuals at this point. And I think you're seeing a lot of leadership from the gymnasts themselves in carving out where gymnastics in the United States is going to go, especially from people like Simone Biles. And, you know, with the bankruptcy filing, it does change the dynamic a little bit, but there had to be some kind of reckoning, and I think this is just the beginning of it.
I will say, too, if you're Michigan Public Radio has put out an excellent podcast called Believed that digs into the Larry Nassar scandal. It is just heartbreaking, riveting. I didn't fully understand everything about how we got to this point and how for so many years people had sort of believed him, and then ultimately it's the gymnast that's being believed. It's really excellent.
It's called Believed by Michigan Radio.
Yes.
With regards to the insurance piece, Kimberly, there's also that aspect of the matter of Les Moonves, the former chairman and CEO of the CBS Corporation. The New York Times reported that Moonves actively obstructed the investigation into the allegations of sexual assault and harassment against him that were leveled by more than a dozen women. He stepped down as the CEO of CBS in September, and one of the issues is this severance package that's worth $120 million.
You know, these golden parachutes have been a real source of pain and frustration for these victims. The idea that people, maybe they'll lose their job, but still get some kind of cushy exit has been very painful for a lot of these women. And there's a real chance that now Moonves might lose his because he is, according to this report, obstructing the investigation. And we had quite a discussion at Marketplace over, you know, what the responsibility is when it comes to a corporate board of notifying your shareholders about something like this, because there were people who knew. And at what point are you obligated legally to start notifying people, hey, this is going to affect our business? Not only does it make us look terrible, not only may there be crimes committed, but this is something that might affect the financials of the organization. So there are a lot of questions that still have to be played out here, and it's the story just keeps getting grosser and grosser, honestly.
A few more quick stories we want to get to before our time is up. Who wouldn't want a free trip to Washington? That's what a group of military veterans were given in exchange for their support of Saudi lobbyists after the last election, the 2016 election. The vets were put up in the Trump International Hotel in downtown D.C. over the course of 3 months for a total of 500 room reservations. The bill came out to $270,000. This and other transactions at the hotel and other Trump-owned entities are the focus of subpoenas filed by attorneys general in Maryland and D.C. this week. Jessica, give us a sense of what this is all about, where this stands, why this matters.
I mean, this was a major step forward in the case that they were allowed to issue these 30 subpoenas. And, you know, this is moving forward. This is the first time that the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution will have been challenged in court. And, you know, it's looking at whether, you know, the Trump organization and, you know, Trump and his really resistance to separate himself from his business, and whether he is receiving a boost by countries and states trying to curry favor with him by having these things there. And I think this story from the Post about the Saudis moving their hotel rooms from Northern Virginia to the Trump Hotel right after the election only sort of seems to give further credence to this fact that countries wanted to sort of curry favor with the president by doing this.
Kim?
One of the problems with that a lot of these charges of emoluments violations have had in the courts up till now have been this idea of demonstrating real harm. And that's why you see so much attention on these hotels and these night stays and the value of these, because Maryland and Virginia can actually lay out, we have hotels and we have properties that previously had that business, and now it's going here. And
right.
So that this is moving forward because, unlike some of these previous groups that have brought these cases, there's harm that they can demonstrate.
A little bit of entertainment news. It's award season coming up in Hollywood. Today we learned that comedian Kevin Hart has pulled out of his role as next year's host of the Oscars. It was made in response to public outcry about past disparaging comments Hart has made regarding LGBTQ people. Offensive tweets from as far back as 2009 have resurfaced in recent days. Hart has addressed them directly on social media. The actor says he is a changed man. He initially declined to apologize and then offered the apology by way of saying he would no longer host the Oscars. Speaking of the awards, the nominations for the Golden Globes came out yesterday, and there were a few surprises.
I, Zuri, son of Badu, give to you Prince T'Challa, the Black Panther.
The blockbuster story of the Marvel superhero from Wakanda was nominated for Best Picture, a category that has historically shunned comic book film adaptations. Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse was also nominated for Best Animated Film. Can you tell we're comic book nerds? I can't tell. In addition to Black Panther, several of the movies we reviewed in the 1A Movie Club got nominated, including Crazy Rich Asians, A Star is Born, and Green Book. They're all up for Best Picture awards. The Golden Globes air Sunday, January 6th. And before we go, one of our listeners named Craig took up my challenge. Craig writes, Rudolph the Redacted Reindeer had some very helpful prose. If you had ever grilled him, you'd know how the story goes.
That's really good.
5 stars to Craig.
Well,
yes.
Played.
Yes, Craig. Please send us your information. Let me send you an autographed 1A mug.
We have to send that to music.
Yes, let me send you some 1A swag. Thank you, Craig. NPR's lead digital political reporter, Jessica Taylor. Thanks, Jessica.
Thanks, Joshua.
Kimberly Adams, senior reporter with Marketplace. Thanks, Kimberly.
Happy to be here.
And David Priest, chief operating officer of the Lawfare Institute. His book is called How to Get Rid of a President, History's Guide to Removing Unpopular, Unable, or Unfit Chief Executives. Thanks, David.
Thank you, Joshua.
1A's lead sound engineer is Jake Cherry. Our digital team is Gabrielle Healy and Catherine Fink. You can learn more about them and the rest of our staff at the1a.org/staff. We'll dive into the international section of the Friday News Roundup in just a moment.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Megatrends, a new podcast from Oppenheimer Funds. There are big investment opportunities beyond our borders. Megatrends explores and explains those opportunities. The show is hosted by author and hedge fund specialist Manit Ahuja. Tune in to hear her talk to the experts about thinking globally when it comes to investing. Subscribe to Megatrends now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
I'm Linda Holmes. There's more stuff to watch these days than you can ever get to. That's why we make Pop Culture Happy Hour. Twice a week, we give you the lowdown on what's worth your time and what's not. Find Pop Culture Happy Hour on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Authorities in France are bracing for more riots. What started as a protest about gas prices has led to tens of thousands of police and security forces being deployed. Museums, theaters, and shops in Paris are being told to close this weekend. World leaders meet in Poland to agree on how best to combat climate change. Reports released this week show global carbon emissions reaching record highs. Also, some lawmakers in Iceland got caught making inappropriate remarks, and the Spanish Navy sails into choppy waters. Plenty to talk about today on the Friday News Roundup, and joining us from NPR in New York is Ravi Agrawal, managing editor of Foreign Policy Magazine. Ravi, welcome.
Great to be on.
Here with us in Washington is Sean Donnan, senior writer for Bloomberg, based here in D.C. Sean, welcome back to 1A.
Wonderful to be here.
Let's begin with some news that was confirmed by the president this morning. President Trump plans to nominate State Department spokeswoman Heather Nauert to be the next U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. She would succeed the outgoing ambassador Nikki Haley. Let's discuss it with NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman, who joins us from the network's headquarters here in D.C. Michelle, welcome.
Hi, nice to be here.
Tell us a bit about Heather Nauert. What's her background?
Well, she came from Fox and Friends, a show that you'll be familiar with because the president talks and tweets about it quite often. And she's been at the State Department just for the past couple of years, starting first with Rex Tillerson. Didn't have much of a relationship with him, but really rose more in the organization under Mike Pompeo, has a very close relationship with him.
Here's the sound of President Trump making that announcement earlier today. It's noisy in the background. You'll hear the whirring chopper blades of Marine One in the background. But here's what the president said.
Heather Nauert will be nominated. She's going to work with Nikki Haley to replace Nikki at the United Nations. She'll be ambassador to the United Nations. She's very talented, very smart, very quick. And I think she's going to be respected by all. So Heather Nauert will be nominated for the ambassador to the United Nations.
President Trump speaking today, standing not far from Marine One. Michelle Kellerman, what are some of the initial impressions to the president's decision?
Well, I mean, I think people agree that she's smart and a quick learner. The question is about her qualifications, because she had never held any government job beforehand. She wasn't a longtime diplomat. She wasn't really steeped in foreign policy. And you got to think about the people that have held this job before. I mean, people like George H.W. Bush, who we've been talking a lot about this week, Jean Kirkpatrick, Madeleine Albright, Tom Pickering, Richard Holbrooke, kind of big names in U.S. foreign policy. And here's someone who doesn't have any of that background. You know, she was a reporter for ABC News and then for Fox News. She was one of the hosts on the Fox and Friends and has been, you know, successful as a State Department spokesperson. But, you know, there's a lot more to the job than being just a spokesperson.
I wonder if we read anything, Michelle, into the kind of ambassador that President Trump might want based on the fact that he has picked or is going to formally nominate Heather Nauert. I mean, the U.S. ambassadors to the U.N. have been such a wide array of people. Samantha Power, Andrew Young, John Negroponte, Madeleine Albright, Bill Richardson. What do we glean about what the president wants from his ambassador, potentially, based on who his new nominee is?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. She, you know, she's a polished spokesperson and she'll be able to give a good speech. She's been a defender of his America First policy and is a good spokesperson for that. And if that's what you want, you're sending a spokesperson to the UN instead of someone who is steeped in how the organization works or the diplomacy around negotiating resolutions. I mean, remember that Nikki Haley also didn't have any foreign policy experience when she was tapped for the job, but she was a politician. And I think, you know, the people at the UN worked well with her. I remember talking to the Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, who's a politician himself, you know, really understood where Nikki Haley was coming from, and they worked together on a lot of things, on UN reforms, pushing ahead U.S. policy on that. I think, you know, you can really see that there's a lot of less interest of the nitty-gritty working of the UN and what the UN's value is in Washington when you send somebody who doesn't have that kind of experience.
Before I come to Ravi for some reaction on Heather Nauert, I did want to ask you about Nikki Haley, Michelle, in terms of the way that it seems like her tenure is ending. She does have her critics, but it was pretty clear the president was quite pleased with her performance. And she also won some people over on the world stage, too.
Oh, she definitely did. And it also built up her credentials if she ever does run for president.
Yeah.
That was clearly one of the things that seemed to be behind a lot of her speeches there. She was quite an independent voice. She made a big point of trying to push back on the anti-Israel bias at the UN. Made some a big show yesterday about that. She tried to get the UN General Assembly to pass a resolution to condemn the Palestinian militant group Hamas. It failed. But she did get quite a few people on her side on that.
Ravi Agrawal, let me bring you into the conversation. What's your read on Heather Nauert's nomination?
Well, there have been reports for quite a while that she may end up being the pick. And I think one of the things this says, of the many things that it says about the Trump administration, is the value of TV. And I say this as a former TV news journalist myself, but it's very clear that Trump has long gotten a lot of his news diet from what he watches on television news, Fox and Friends being one of his chief sources, which is the show that Heather Nauert used to anchor when she was at Fox News. And then that in turn leads to some of his decision making. And so it's interesting here that he's picked someone who clearly is very capable at messaging and very capable of presenting and taking messages from the administration and being able to present them to the world at press conferences, being able to field questions, tough questions from reporters, and come across as very composed and able to sort of walk through muddied waters quite well. And what's interesting here is that we know that Trump is not the biggest fan of multilateralism. And you know, this is a position that is all about multilateralism. It is the ambassador to the UN, which, you know, is founded on cooperation with other countries. And so it's anyone who has to be in this position in this administration would necessarily need to be able to juggle the contradictions of what is expected from the role. And in that sense, you would imagine that a TV anchor, a former TV anchor, would be very well placed to do that. However, as we've just been discussing, there are all the other things of the nuts and bolts of diplomacy, the being steeped in the world of foreign policy, as so many former holders of that position have been, from Holbrooke to Susan Rice to George H.W. Bush, and problems will emerge there. And I think that's why we're beginning to hear rumblings of discontent about her being relatively inexperienced for this role.
Yeah, Sean Donnan, I wonder what your take is on that as well. I do take Ravi's point in terms of the forward-facing part of the UN ambassador role. Sanders Dogman posted, "She'll put on a good show. That's all that matters." Sean, of course, there's more to that than diplomacy. There's the part that happens in front of the cameras. And then a lot of diplomacy is the stuff that we never see that happens in phone calls and hallway meetings and behind the scenes. We don't know if Heather Nauert would be good at that or not. She might be fine, but it seems like that's the bigger part of the job.
Yeah, and just the fact that we're having this conversation speaks to one way you can read this appointment, which is simply a reduction of the role. You know, this appointment comes in a week when Mike Pompeo was in Brussels and he was launching arrows at multilateral institutions, including the UN, the European Union as an alliance, the World Trade Organization, and so on. That skepticism of multilateral institutions, which Ravi was talking about, hasn't gone away in this administration. And it's, if anything, has kind of stepped up since John Bolton took over as National Security Advisor. He's a long-term skeptic of the United Nations. So it's hard to see this as an appointment that kind of lives up to the history of the role. And I think a lot of people at the UN are going to read it that way.
Michelle, I know we got to let you go in just a second, but I wonder, presuming that Heather Nauert is nominated, becomes the ambassador, give us a sense of what some of the biggest issues are that she would need to be dealing with as the ambassador. Is it China? Is it the conflict between Russia and Ukraine? The crisis in Yemen? Our relationship with Saudi Arabia? Is there a list of priorities at the top, or does it all kind of hit boom at the same time?
Well, it's all of those things. I mean, especially since Russia and China are on the Security Council.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's going to be another summit coming up with North Korea. Nikki Haley was quite successful in getting the world rallied around very tough sanctions on North Korea to pave the way for the first summit. But, you know, those sanctions and that sort of pressure has been peeling away. So keeping the world united on North Korea is going to be one really big challenge. The U.S. has also walked away from the Iran nuclear deal, and it wants the world to counter Iranian malign activity, as they call it, throughout the region. The U.N. is going to be one of those places where you have to work on that. So there's going to be a lot of very big issues on her plate.
And right quick before we let you go, any world reaction to the news of this, or is it too soon to have heard from other world leaders?
I haven't seen. I mean, mostly I've been watching kind of the regular UN watchers who see this as a little bit of a signal to the UN of what the Trump administration thinks of it, that this is not the center of the world, and probably downgrading it. We were talking before about how Nikki Haley, she insisted on having it be a cabinet level post.
Right.
We haven't heard yet, but it will more likely be a sub-cabinet post, as most Republican administrations see it.
That's NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman. Michelle, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
Let's talk about the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia, which seems to be getting more and more complicated and tense by the passing weeks. On Tuesday, behind closed doors, Gina Haspel, who's the director of the CIA, briefed a small group of senators about the murder of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi. Apparently, what they heard left them pretty furious and with zero doubt that the Saudi Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, ordered that murder. Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, said that America's relationship with the kingdom is important, but
we'll do more damage to our standing in the world by ignoring MBS than dealing with him. MBS, the Crown Prince, is a wrecking ball. I think the behavior before the Khashoggi murder was beyond disturbing, and I cannot see him being a reliable partner to the United States.
That's Republican Senator Lindsey Graham. He also added that this is not just a smoking gun. He described it as a smoking saw. Kind of a grisly image, Ravi, but it speaks to the dramatic change in the way that senators view this. What do you see behind this strong flip in perspective, or at least this strengthening of perspective on what happened?
Well, I think certainly it has something to do with the Gina Haspel hearing, which was obviously closed door. But it's telling that immediately after, one of the other things that Senator Graham said is that they now know that definitively MBS was complicit, quote, complicit in the murder of Mr. Khashoggi. So for them to be able to say that means that they certainly got some information from Haspel that showed them evidence that that was the case. And so that linking of the killing to the Crown Prince all the way up to the top now means that, you know, U.S. lawmakers can no longer turn a blind eye to his direct role and therefore the wider relationship. And so this has been building for some time. And if anything, it's a surprise that it's taken this long for matters to reach the stage that it has. And obviously with this comes so many other things that will come sort of churning out, from you know, the crisis in Yemen, which is ongoing, to many other things, to Saudi cooperation in the oil market, to you know, obviously Trump wants OPEC to be able to pump more oil so that prices are low. Saudi's a big part of that. And it really raises questions about many other things that the U.S. and Saudi Arabia would cooperate on.
Yeah, Sean, you and I were talking about OPEC, and I do take Rafi's point in terms of lawmakers not being able to turn a blind eye to this, but the president has still been equivocal at best on Saudi Arabia's direct role in Jamal Khashoggi's murder, including kind of brushing aside some of the intelligence that's been brought forward. There seem to be these two different roles. There's the Senate, which is increasingly solid, and then the president, whose relationship with Saudi Arabia still feels as transactional as ever.
Right, absolutely. The president saw exactly the same and got the same briefing that the senators did and chose to take a very different view of it, was that this is a tragic event. This is a grisly event. But there's a bigger economic relationship at play here. And he has a number of times come out in statements and on Twitter and made that point. And he's also made the point, he's very directly linked his relationship with MBS, the Crown Prince, to low oil prices and a move by Saudi Arabia to keep oil prices low. Well, today in Vienna, we've seen the Saudis team up with the Russians to do the reverse. In fact, throwing a bit of shade at President Trump by deciding to cut production to try and boost oil prices, do the exact opposite of what he was calling for just a few days ago. So his transactional relationship has limits, and that's what we've learned. And a few days ago, a week ago at the G20 in Buenos Aires, we saw this amazing scene of Vladimir Putin and MBS, the Crown Prince, greeting each other with this kind of high five, jocular handshake, and so on. And we saw President Trump kind of glaring at them in the distance. And, you know,
A very chummy. It was like you meet your friend at the bar to watch the game. It was that kind of handshake.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. This was two men who clearly liked each other, right, and get along. And President Trump, you can almost see him kind of glowering in the distance, kind of wanting to be part of that that relationship. And the answer a week on is that those two men have teamed up and they've kind of, you know, said, well, oil prices, they're going to go up, and Donald Trump, you can't do very much about it.
One more clip, Ruffy, that I'd love you to react to before we keep moving. This is Republican Senator Marco Rubio of Florida. He sits on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and his tone is kind of at odds from what we heard earlier. Senator Rubio was interviewed on CNN. He had been asked to explain why the U.S. would be willing to stand by a country that thinks it can get away with murder. Here's part of what Senator Rubio said.
If we stop supporting the Saudis, you're going to see an increase in the Houthis' attacks against Saudi Arabia. And I mean strikes with UAVs and strikes with rockets that could actually kill civilians and even members of the royal family. And that's only going to trigger a larger response. And before you know it, there's an all-out shooting war, I mean, beyond just this proxy war, not to mention the threat the Houthis pose to the shipping lanes that lead to the Indian Ocean, where all this oil and energy for the world goes through every single day. We could get pulled into that as well.
That's Republican Senator Marco Rubio of Florida speaking on CNN. Now, we'll talk about Yemen for a moment. We'll talk more about Yemen in just a moment. But, Ravi, I wonder how you hear Senator Rubio's remarks, particularly this idea that there are few absolutes in foreign policy and you kind of have to take the world as it is and not as you wish it to be.
Well, if he sounded like he was tying himself up in a pretzel, it's because he was. And that's the nature of the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia, because it's long been a place where American interests and values have collided. And this is exactly what you're seeing there. And, you know, the chumminess, I think, of as you beautifully referred to, the high five between Putin and MBS at the G20 summit is so important here, because, you know, that alignment, that chumminess, speaks to an alignment not just in political interests, but also in political values. And so what we're seeing this week is actually quite significant in that, you know, as Saudi and Russia collude to, or work together, I should say, quite openly to, get oil prices to go up a little bit, which both need it to be at, since they are both net exporters of oil and depend heavily on oil revenue. It could be a sign of the future. It could be a sign of two countries that need each other and are comfortable with that. And what this could also mean is that we are approaching a point where the U.S. and Saudi Arabia now clearly and have open differences of interest, but also maybe their interests in terms of where they stand politically and globally and in terms of values are more exposed out in the open and therefore in question.
Sean?
Well, I think what we heard from Marco Rubio there was this kind of long-standing American view of the Middle East and of Saudi Arabia as the great provider of stability in the Gulf. Well, the big question in the rest of the world right now is whether MBS is in fact a source of instability in the Gulf, both in terms of the conflict that he's been waging, proxy conflict in Yemen, but also in the way he's taken on people in Qatar, the rulers there, and almost put in an embargo embargo in place on them. And then there's this question of the changing kind of economic relationships where, you know, the U.S. did something pretty remarkable last week that not many people noticed. And that was for the first time in 75 years, the U.S. became a net oil exporter, the first time since Harry Truman was in the White House. And that is speaks to the changing relationship. The U.S. probably isn't as dependent on Saudi Arabia as it once was.
And as technology advances, Sean, you know, as we go to different forms of cars and, you know, who knows what will happen with hybrids and electrics and who knows what else, that's going to change even further.
Absolutely. That's the argument. You know, oil is kind of yesterday's fuel.
Let's talk a little bit more about Yemen. A few quick comments from you before we move on. Pat is in Oakland Township, Michigan. Pat writes, "Greed wins again. Our president wants to keep his business opportunities open, and this is what we have." And Aaron posts, "We don't have to support MBS's leadership of Saudi Arabia in order to support the country. He is not the country." Ravi, I would take issue with that. I wonder what your thought is on Aaron's post. Mohammed bin Salman has been trying to make himself the face and the voice and the presence of Saudi Arabia, if for no other reason than to portray Saudi Arabia as a 21st century country that the whole world should be doing business in. I hear what Aaron's getting at, but practically I don't know how you separate Mohammed bin Salman from Saudi Arabia.
Well, that's right. It's not a democracy. It's as simple as that. I mean, he's the crown prince, and he is able to do pretty much exactly as he wants. And, you know, I mean, the tough moves he's taken so far, I mean, imprisoning, you know, locking up many of his cousins in a hotel, for example, or, you know, taking on, you know, trying to present a more moderate face of Islam, which you know, famously many commentators in the West saw as something that would be one of MBS's big fights that could help the world and the region. So there's stuff like that, but at the same time, it's so clear that he has authoritarian, clearly, you know, tendencies where he is quite happy to ride roughshod over public opinion, over freedom of speech, over human rights. And that's just the way it is. So, you know, he is not the country, but, you know, in terms of his power, in terms of the monarchy, he pretty much is. And that's, in any case, for anyone who's not in Saudi Arabia, he is who you're doing business with.
We should say a note about Yemen before we move on, because this week, for the first time in more than 2 years, the Yemeni government and the Houthi rebels are holding face-to-face peace talks. Representatives of both sides met at a castle in Sweden at a time when the humanitarian crisis in Yemen is getting worse. According to the United Nations, as we speak, every 10 minutes, a child under 5 dies in Yemen. A child under 5 every 10 minutes. The executive director of the World Food Program, David Beasley, spoke on Wednesday to the BBC.
"We've been feeding, supporting about 8 million people per month at a cost of about $100 million, and we're anticipating the new numbers of those who are on the brink of starvation to increase from 8 to somewhere around 12 to 15 million people. And I literally saw children in the hospitals dying right before my very own eyes. It is a bad situation."
That's David Beasley, the director of the World Food Program, executive director of the World Food Program, speaking to the BBC. Ravi, let me stick with you very briefly before we keep moving. What do we expect to come of these talks?
Well, we shouldn't really expect any great breakthroughs. I think all signs from the conference so far point to just baby steps, confidence-building measures. Just trying to get both sides to the table in and of itself is a big step. And I think, you know, some of the confidence-building measures include just, you know, an exchange of detainees, a prisoner swap of sorts. And all the signs point to even that being a pretty big step for now. So downplaying expectations is probably wise.
France's President Emmanuel Macron is the target of a mounting political crisis playing out in the streets of Paris. Macron's move to make new fuel taxes to cut carbon emissions angered a group that's been called the Yellow Vests in English. The group of mostly non-urban motorists took to the streets of Paris in violent protest last weekend. At least 130 people got hurt. More than 400 were arrested. Time magazine captured some sound of the protests.
Thank you.
Now France is gearing up for the potential of more violent protests this weekend. Sean Donna, let me come to you with regard to this group, the Yellow Vest, the Gilets Jaunes, as they are called in French. What's the story behind all this? I mean, this is about raising the price of gas?
So Macron, as part of his encouraging, this gets into our last story as well, it's part of encouraging people to use less gas, increase the gas tax, the same kind of taxes that you or I would pay at the gas pump here in the United States, often at the state level. And that really drew a revolt from all those people out there who driving and paying high prices already for gas. The name comes, the Yellow Jackets, comes from the fact that every driver in France has to have kind of yellow safety vests in the trunk. It's part of the regular kit, and so they're putting it on stating their love of driving, but also just how this is an everyday part of their life. Macron's popularity is just down in the dumps. I mean, his approval rating is at 23%. This is not going to stop here. It is not a simple micro issue about gas prices. It's more broadly about the kind of reforms, the economic reforms that he's trying to push through. We're seeing a lot of people out there call for his resignation and call for his scalp.
What was his argument for raising gas prices?
It was, you know, part of getting the country to pivot away from fossil fuels. It was part of these kind of sensible economic reforms, you know, disincentive to use gas. It's something that people have talked about in the United States as a great way to stop people driving so much. It's sensible policy in theory.
And yet, you know, they're saying that the last weekend's protests were France's worst protests in 50 years. The French government is planning to deploy upwards of 90,000 officers for security, 90,000 for security tomorrow. The Eiffel Tower is planning to close. The Louvre is planning to close. This is not the Emmanuel Macron that the world expected. We thought he was going to be this guy who could kind of walk the line between more progressive reforms while still being very business-minded, being an outsider from the political establishment, being an extremely strong rebuke to Jean-Marie Le Pen. But this doesn't seem to be going well.
No, absolutely. He was a model for the kind of internationalists, the young internationalists who were going to be a rebuke to the populists who had won other elections. But, you know, this is not just an issue for France. This is an issue for Europe in general. We now have the leaders of the two biggest economies in continental Europe, Angela Merkel and Macron, looking very weak.
I should say Marine Le Pen. Jean-Marie Le Pen was her father. But yeah, this kind of an interesting rebuke to them. And as it relates to climate change, it's interesting because there was a UN climate summit in Poland this week, and Sir David Attenborough spoke on Monday. If you've ever watched the classic episodes of Planet Earth on BBC America, you know who Sir David Attenborough is. And he gave a message about the dangers of not doing enough on climate change.
If we don't take action, the collapse of our civilizations and the extinction of much of the natural world is on the horizon. Leaders of the world, you must lead the continuation of our civilizations and the natural world upon which we depend is in your hands.
That's Sir David Attenborough speaking to delegates at the UN Climate Summit in Poland, warning about the dangers of inaction on climate change. Very bold statements, but he's certainly not alone in his grave concerns. He was speaking to a delegation of nearly 200 nations. When we come back, Ravi, I'd love to get your sense of what this year's conference is focusing on and, frankly, whether or not anybody is listening when we continue with the Friday News Roundup. And, of course, before we go, we should talk about Spain's national anthem and why it struck the wrong chord with the British Royal Navy this week. Literally. Stay close.
The following message comes from our sponsor, Capital One. Here's Sarah Strauss, head of fraud at Capital One, on how the CreditWise app helps users quickly take action by alerting them to potential signs of fraud.
It's really about actively trying to detect fraud as it's occurring. There's just a much greater opportunity now for consumers to really own this and to feel empowered to go after the issue and resolve it.
CreditWise from Capital One is an app that helps you quickly detect fraud for free, whether you're a Capital One customer or not. You can find CreditWise in your app or Play Store now.
This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We do long-form interviews with the people behind the best books, pop culture, journalism, and more, so you can get to know the people whose work you love. You'll find Fresh Air on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
Ravi, love to get your sense on this climate conference, this UN climate summit in Poland, which is broadly referred to as COP24, COP24. What's your take on the focus of this year's conference and whether or not world leaders will come away from it emboldened to do more?
Well, the focus this year is basically to try and get all of the countries that are there to come to an agreement on how to report the progress they've made towards what is known as nationally determined contributions. That sounds complicated, but basically it goes back to the Paris Agreement's term for emissions reduction goals. And the Paris Agreement, of course, was the big conference in 2015 where countries largely agreed on how much to reduce their carbon emissions by. Now, the problem at COP24 in Poland, and there are so many of them, is that all of the divisions between countries, rich and poor, carbon emitting countries, oil exporters, and, you know, countries that are small islands endangered immediately by climate change, the disagreements that have always existed between them still exist. And the worrying signs are that despite all the data we have, despite all the talk, and despite all the knowledge we now have about the dangers, the real and present dangers of climate change, countries still haven't really been able to agree on who pays, who gets to pay how much for poorer countries to be able to mitigate the effects of climate change, who reduces their emissions by how much. And all of those things are being hotly debated right now in a climate where you have President Trump, who said that he wants to walk away from the Paris Agreement. You have newly elected leaders like Bolsonaro in Brazil, who has also said that he wants to walk away from some of the agreements that were struck in Paris. Right. So it's a very troubled sort of moment for climate change, where the science has never been clearer and cooperation still seems to be something that is hard to come by.
Let's back up to the story of Jamal Khashoggi for a moment. We've gotten some of your comments about this and about kind of the importance, the spotlight that we put on this or perhaps should put on this. And I wanted to address two of them before we keep moving. Sean emailed, "I get it. It's okay for Barack Obama to order the killing of another country's citizen and have his body thrown overboard into the ocean, but it's not okay for another country to do something similar. And don't say it's different, because it is the same thing." I think I can take this one, Sean. Osama bin Laden masterminded the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Jamal Khashoggi was killed for criticizing another government. He was killed for exercising the First Amendment. They're not the same thing.
Yeah, one was a terrorist, one was a journalist.
Bill emailed, "Since you hung your star on Jamal, Iran let off a rocket in violation to Obama's and Kerry's Iranian deal. Crickets from the left? Only you in Washington give a rat about Jamal. Busting MBS on something that's not our business only strengthens Iran and, by extension, Russia." Ravi, I wonder if you could respond to Bill. First of all, Jamal Khashoggi was a U.S. resident. He was a journalist working for The Washington Post, exercising his First Amendment freedom. So, yeah, you're damn right we give a rat about it. However, I do see Bill's point. He's asking about the place that this should take in terms of everything else that's going on, including Iran, including Russia. How do you see that, the balance of all this?
Look, it is a difficult balance, and as has long been the relationship with Saudi Arabia. But, you know, the one thing that has always set the United States apart from the likes of Russia is that it has stood up publicly for human rights. It has stood up publicly for press freedoms. It is seen in many parts of the world as a beacon for all of these rights. And, you know, ignoring them would be dangerous, would set a precedent that would harm the American reputation, would harm American workers around the world in ways that would be, you know, difficult to recover from. And so for all of those reasons, I think it is very, very important for the U.S. to stand up for what it believes in and to continue to be a leader on that front.
Speaking of our difficult U.S. relationships with the rest of the world, Sean, that also came up with a story related to China this week that I'd like you to help walk us through. This company called Huawei, that I think a lot of Americans have never really heard of, because how many of you have a Huawei cell phone? But a top executive and the daughter of the company's founder, this Chinese tech giant, was arrested on Saturday in Canada at the request of the United States. So let's walk through this in pieces, Sean. First of all, what is Huawei?
Huawei is one of the world's largest telecommunications companies. The reason you don't know about it here in the United States is that the U.S. for a long time has waged a campaign to keep Huawei and its handsets, its telecommunications routers, and so on out of the United States because the intelligence community here in the United States has long had a concern that Huawei and its founder came from the People's Liberation Army in China, that Huawei is somehow worked with Chinese intelligence and that by using those handsets, by using the routers and so on, you would be compromising the telecommunications network here in the United States.
Now, the argument for her arrest had to do with U.S. sanctions against Iran. Is that right?
Absolutely. So there's a second piece of this. Actually, U.S. companies sell a lot of parts to Huawei that it puts into its telecommunications equipment. But under U.S. sanctions of Iran, Huawei, in theory, is banned from selling those pieces of equipment that contain certain U.S. parts to countries like Iran and North Korea. We saw this earlier this year with another Chinese company called ZTE, which is the kind of junior Huawei, if you will. They got caught selling parts to Iran and trying to hide it. And that led to sanctions from the Trump administration that almost shut the company down.
So the U.S. companies can sell parts to Huawei, but Huawei can't sell phones in Iran that contain those U.S. parts.
Absolutely.
What does this mean for the larger U.S.-China trade fight? China's called for these executives to be released. Last weekend, the president announced that he and China's President Xi Jinping had reached what he called an incredible deal to temporarily suspend the trade war. Days later, the president declared, "I'm a tariff man." Where does this put us? Where do we know?
We don't know. And then I think that's the really telling thing a week on from this dinner. They came out of dinner in Saturday, the steak dinner in Buenos Aires at the close of the G20, and there seemed to be a pretty good deal. This was about the best case scenario anyone expected. The Trump administration agreed to pause raising further tariffs on China. There were $200 billion in imports that are due to be hit with a 25% tariff in January. Trump administration has said we'll hold off on that for 90 days while we have some talks. That was a kind of welcome pause for a lot of American companies, consumers, and the stock markets. But then this deal seemed to kind of crumble because we just don't know what the details of it are. And we don't know that either side are living up to it. And then we had this spectacular event in terms of the arrest of the chief financial officer of Huawei. This is the equivalent of China arresting a senior Apple executive. This is a national champion for China. And it sends a terrible message when you're having these kind of economic talks there. The administration insists these aren't related, that this was that the arrest was related to a Justice Department case that they're pursuing. But, you know, we've seen this in the past, the kind of this in some ways gets into the credibility of the Trump administration. The president has made clear that he wants to see the Justice Department do certain things in terms of domestic investigations here in the U.S. And so other countries have certainly noticed that.
Matt wrote, "I considered getting a Huawei phone a few years ago. Super glad I didn't." Let's move on to a story out of Egypt. Last week, an Egyptian actor named Rania Youssef walked the red carpet in Cairo at the 40th annual Cairo International Film Festival. According to the New York Times, this week she was sued by three lawyers over the dress she wore. Rania Youssef is due in court on January 12th. Ravi Agrawal, what is this about?
Well, she was wearing a dress that was, one could say it was a little bit revealing. It was a see-through kind of sheer dress that revealed her legs, and more than what she wore. I think this speaks to where Egypt is right now, where obviously they still have an authoritarian president in Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, and this is one of many cases they've had recently where they've targeted celebrities, there's a sort of police, moral police, that is trying to regulate the attire and behavior and even the jokes that famous Egyptians make in public, as a means to sort of suppress the people.
Now, I'm looking at a picture of the dress. Just to describe it, it's sleeveless. The top is black, sparkly, opaque. The bottoms of the dress, the dress kind of shows her legs very clearly. It doesn't really cover her skin. It covers her, but you can see her legs quite clearly. It's not like super duper revealing, but you can clearly see through it. There's kind of a diamond pattern tessellated grid over under the first layer of the dress. Is this really about punishing Rania Yusuf? Is this just about sending a message? I mean, where do we expect this to go?
I think this is about sending a message, and it's a very contradictory message, because let's be clear, this was not a religious event. This was the Cairo International Film Festival that she appeared at. She was on a red carpet. It's pretty standard for actresses, actors in that part of the world and around the world to wear clothes that are fashion forward. And, you know, I mean, behind her in the pictures we've seen of her are advertisers that are Western advertisers that are quite used to people wearing those kinds of clothes. So this really is a statement not aimed at her in particular, but a statement aimed at the people. It's a show of force. It's a show of control. It's a show of, you know, the fact that the state wants to delve into people's tastes and clothes and things that they do. And I think that's how it will be seen as well.
Cubans were given some new freedom this week that a lot of us maybe take for granted. Citizens in that communist country can now use the internet on their phones. Cuba's state-run telephone company is now offering mobile plans that include internet access. Of course, it's only available to those who can afford it. A nonprofit group called Freedom House called Cuba, quote, one of the world's least connected and most repressive environments for information and communication technologies, unquote. Now, Sean, Cubans who want to access the web on their phones will need to pay the equivalent of $30 for 4 gigabytes of data. That's pretty steep in a country where most of the population lives on $100 or less a month. And anyone who uses Netflix or downloads movies or video games knows that 4 gigabytes can go just like that. But it's a step forward.
Yeah, this certainly isn't unlimited internet access, is it?
No.
And in my household, we'd burn through that in a week. But Cuba's opening up. Maybe this is maybe something encouraging, but let's remember that Cuba has one of the world's lowest rates of internet penetration and use, and that home internet, that kind of the old dial-up connection that all of us have had for a few decades here in the United States, only was allowed in 2017. Baby steps, expensive baby steps for a lot of Cubans. Let's see where it goes.
But still a big move. It's a move that I think a lot of people had been looking forward to in terms of being able to make Cuba more open just culturally.
Yeah, but the thing I immediately thought of when I read this story was China. And remember going back a couple of decades when we thought the internet was going to change China and was going to bring an end to authoritarianism there and democracy? What we've learned instead is that China has become really good at blocking out the parts of the internet that it doesn't want to allow. I'm sure there's some Chinese companies that are going to be selling some of that technology to Cuban companies.
Yeah, China kind of made the internet wrap around itself in a way. Another story we wanted to get to before our time is up. It has to do with Britain. I mean, it's been arguably a rough week for the British. Brexit has gone from bad to worse. A key vote scheduled in Parliament next week. If Theresa May cannot get her deal through the House of Commons, many expect her to step down as the Prime Minister. But then there's something that happened off the coast of Gibraltar, a tiny British enclave bordered by Spain and the Mediterranean Sea. This is the moment that a Spanish warship sparked outrage, and not just for sailing where it should not have. A cell phone video appears to show a warship from the Spanish fleet in British waters blaring out the Spanish national anthem. Now, officials believe the audio may have been doctored, but still, the warship was chased out of the area by the Royal Navy. Britain is still on track to leave the European Union in 2019. It joined the EU in 1973, and it sank the Spanish Armada in 1588. But, Ravi Agrawal, what's up with this story? Were they just kind of trolling the British for some reason?
It seems like it.
And in such style. In such style.
I mean, you couldn't make it up, just blaring out the national anthem like that. And then the fact that it was recorded by a user on a cell phone and then it was put on Twitter. I mean, it's very much a 2018 story. Peak 2018, peak internet, peak ridiculousness. And you know, if that was our biggest story of the day, that would be nice, probably.
Wouldn't that be lovely if the best story was just like, oh, look at these whacking Spaniards. They sailed into Britain. But there is the larger issue, Sean, before we go, of, you know, it was an incursion into British waters, and Britain does have bigger things to deal with. But, you know, the UK's relationships with the rest of Europe, this is going to be the least of their worries.
Yeah, you know, I'm going to be that guy who says there's a serious underlying issue here.
Be that guy.
Be that guy. You know, Brexit is a mess. It's not getting any better. Right now, we've got Theresa May setting up for a vote in Parliament next week on her plans for an exit, which is kind of a soft Brexit, as they call it. Looks like that may go down in Parliament. And Gibraltar has been a long-standing source of friction between Spain and the UK. And in fact, the Spanish government was kind of holding up its approval for the Brexit plans, you know, while it was raising questions over Gibraltar. So, you know, it's fun. It's a wonderful song. I like that anthem. you know, there's a mess there.
Sean Donnan, senior writer for Bloomberg News. Sean, thanks for spending the hour with us.
Wonderful to be here.
And Ravi Agrawal, managing editor of Foreign Policy Magazine. Thanks, Ravi.
Thanks very much.
Hey, by the way, before we go, now is the good time to send us your story suggestions for shows and topics in the new year. We're making a tradition. We want you to set our January programming agenda. You can find out more about how to send us your ideas online at the1a.org and click Ask 1A. That's the word the number one, the letter A.org and click Ask 1A. 1A senior team includes Lindsay Thomas, Danielle Knight, and Gabe Bullard. To learn more about them and the rest of our staff, visit the1a.org/staff. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening, and enjoy your weekend. This is 1A.